Hi, everybody. This is Kevin Rothrock of Runet Echo at Global Voices, and I want to thank everyone for their patience, anyone who's still listening live and anybody who is tuning in later on the recorded feed. Myself and my colleague, Andrei Tselikov, my co-editor at Runet Echo, we're going to be discussing the aftermath, the consequences, the drama of the Russian local and regional elections that took place last Sunday. And it's now been, today's Friday, so it's been almost a week since the elections, and so there's plenty of news to discuss, plenty of online reactions that Andre and I have been monitoring throughout the week. And we've drawn up a list of several questions, including a few submitted by readers, by the audience, by you, that we're going to go through to try to unpack some of what's happened, what it might mean, and what in all this drama is interesting. So I want to thank you again for tuning in, or for tuning in live, or later. And so I suppose we'll just get right into it, and I will start with some of these questions. And Andre and I, the idea here is we want to have a conversation about the elections, and hopefully that will be lively and that you will enjoy it. So the first question is, what is the use of social media and citizen journalism in Russia's recent elections? Was the use of social media and citizen journalism in Russia's recent elections something that actively shaped the course of voting and reactions in voting results? Or would it be more accurate to describe the Runet, the Russian internet, as just a reflection of offline events? And so Andre, before I ask you to chime in on that, one thing I wanted to say about Runet Echo that often goes unsaid in our work is that, in part because of my expertise, because of Andre's expertise, we often comment on sort of raw politics. And it's especially apt right now with the elections just having happened. But one thing that I think is unique about the Russian blogosphere that cannot be said of all other blogospheres, it could probably be said about some, but not all of them, is that Russia, because as a political space, as a culture, it's more limited in, say, the public sphere. A lot of the social commentary, the political commentary, gets pushed into the blogosphere, where there is a much more open environment. And so a lot of the people that are active in the Russian blogosphere, the people that we're most often following, quoting, analyzing, they are journalists, they're politicians, they're people that in perhaps a more open society would not need to resort to the blogosphere, to sort of these private channels or public-private channels the way they do in Russia. So I do think that it makes Russia a kind of unique place, and that's why to discuss Russian politics as it exists sort of outside of strictly government channels, talking about the blogosphere, understanding the blogosphere is really important. And so that's kind of in part an answer to the question. But Andre, what do you think about offline, online reflections and so on?
So, let me pick up on something that you just said, that perhaps in a different environment, people, all of these politicians and bloggers would be less likely to take to the blogs, and maybe more likely to take to the TV or cable or something, where you're thinking Fox or MSNBC. What blogs allow them to do, I think, is that they allow them to be more expressive. I mean, the amount of swearing, the amount of hijinks, the amount of just pure trolling that goes on wouldn't fly in a more regulated environment of, either television or newspapers, or even the radio. And a lot of them do have access to the radio with Echo of Moscow.
Sure.
Radio station. But coming back to the original question, was the coverage a reflection, or was it some sort of something that affected the voting process? I would say that it was more of a reflection, because yes, there was some mobilization efforts happening, and certainly as the day went on, as the voting went on, it was clear that the turnout was very low. People tried to bolster the turnout, all sorts of activists tweeted and posted on Facebook and live journals saying, if you come out and vote. But did that really, you know, can we really think that that improved the turnout, or is it just that as the day went on, younger people woke up on a Sunday?
Right. Well, yeah. Andre and I were actually monitoring the whole thing. We're blogging, live blogging, for about 14 hours, beginning at Moscow time 8 a.m. So when the polls opened. And so we were there the entire time, and I think we both noticed that a lot of the kind of movers and shakers of the political opposition, they didn't even start tweeting until several hours into it, which indicated to us that they, that they had, in fact, some of them were honest about it. They literally tweeted like, "Hey, I just woke up. What's happening?" And this was like nearly noon for some of them, which gives you sort of an idea of what kind of click we're talking about here. When it comes to the kind of trendsetters in the Russian blogosphere.
Well, also, apparently there were several huge parties the night before with all of these sort of near political and journalists.
Right.
Present, so.
Yeah. That's another interesting thing. I've noticed kind of differences in the way the different platforms, and this mostly applies, I suppose, to kind of the journalist core and the activist sort of oppositionist figures. I guess most of them are activists. Some of them are just kind of public intellectuals. Like, I don't know. I was actually trying to think. Some of these people are hard to sort of classify. Like, Masha Baronova is like, so what is she exactly? She's a political prisoner. She's a former activist.
I mean,
formerly
former
she was
activist.
A former, right, but only briefly when she worked with Ponomaryov. And that was only for a very little bit. And other than that, she just sort of speaks publicly. She's almost like a public intellectual.
Well, so in Russia, there is the term for this, right? It's called publicist, right? A publicist, the person who publishes things, which, you know, that's obviously, you know, that speaks to that. It's a very sort of generic public intellectual role. And, you know, it's interesting that in Russian, there's an actual specific one word term for that.
Well, it's kind of similar, I suppose, in the United States to like a talking head. But usually a talking head has a formal position somewhere and they're called upon to provide expertise on various issues. Whereas these publicists or whatever.
Pundit. But
pundit, yeah. But whatever.
A pundit gets invited by somebody to give their opinion.
Right.
Whereas here people are volunteering their opinion and
it
gets dispersed into the.
But there are certain people who seem to have more of like an audience, and so they can be called on or expected to kind of chime in.
Sure.
So the two things I wanted to point out about reflection versus, I don't know, causal in terms of the internet and the elections. One, Andre, you mentioned like that the Russian bloggers are trying to increase turnout by, you know, stirring things up on Twitter and on LiveJournal and Facebook as the vote progressed, because it became apparent as precincts reported that, or as monitors reported on precincts, I suppose, that turnout was quite low, and it finished quite low.
But in the beginning, it was extremely low.
It was extremely low, right? So this
5%, 10%.
Yeah, and it finished. And do you remember?
I think the official number is 33 or 34. Something.
But then there was but Golis actually. There's a monitoring agency called Golis that actually. I don't know. Did you see this, Andre? That they determined that like someone had drawn in an extra zero on one of the precincts that added. It added 20,000 people to like the registered total, so that the turnout was underestimated, because it was taking it from a total 20,000 people larger than it should have been.
Whoa,
so it was like 0.02 underestimated or whatever.
Right.
But at any rate, so there were these efforts on Facebook, on Twitter to encourage turnout. There's some evidence that it may have worked, although who's to say that it wasn't just people getting off work, just people voting after work instead of before.
Well, I mean, this was a Sunday, right? So.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
People weren't at work, but people have
finishing
other,
their day
other things
or whatever,
to do, right?
Yeah. Right.
I mean, some of the activists I remember seeing didn't vote until maybe 5 minutes before polls closed.
Right. Right. And they were and kind of
they were
oddly, they were revealing what was kind of. what is not exactly something you'd sort of brag about, but
yeah, exactly.
That's part of the amusing power of the Russian internet, I suppose.
Yeah.
But then the other thing I was going to say was that Golos, they had this map of election violations that they've run in the past, in past elections, and in the past it's been a real big factor. This time I don't know. People are citing it because of the final tally that they had was lower. It puts Sobyanin under the 50% mark. Sobyanin, by the way, if I probably should have stated this at the beginning, Sobyanin is the incumbent and now re-inaugurated mayor of Moscow. Alexei Navalny was the chief rival. And Sobyanin won narrowly with just over 51%. If he had scored anything under 50%, there would have been a second runoff round. Now, Golos, they have this website, the map of election violations, and I never know if it's actually a DDoS attack, if it's denial of service, if it's hackers, or if it just gets too much traffic, or if it's a poorly managed website. I don't know. Of course, websites are always going to claim it was a DDoS attack. There's probably reason to believe it was this time around, just because Golos is often targeted, if not by hackers, then by like the tax police and so on. So they are a persecuted organization. And now they used to be an association, now they're a movement. This is, again, the consequence of sort of the legal necessities in the current environment for NGOs in Russia. But at any rate, the website went down, but the figures still kept going out because they intelligently invited people to their headquarters, I guess, because Varlamov, for instance, who is one of Russia's most famous photo bloggers, he was tweeting the latest stats from there, and some other people were. I wasn't sure if they were just repeating what he was, or at any rate, they had people in their headquarters.
Well, this was the monitor's headquarters. I don't think it was Golos. It was Golos and other monitoring organizations all headquartered together in one massive HQ with about 100 people watching live feeds. Amongst other things.
So this is the SMS Tsik thing or whatever it was, right?
They are also, so if you look at SMS Tsik, the people calling in are people from different monitoring groups. There's Golos, there's
can you explain exactly what, for people that don't know what SMS Tsik is?
So it's a very neat initiative where basically election monitors who are present for the counting of the votes, once the votes at a precinct have been counted, they will text or email the results to this central hub organized by Golos amongst other organizations, and this central hub will then collate the results. And it's sort of a parallel counting process to the actual official electoral committee counting process. And in some ways it's faster as well.
And they had about 60% coverage.
Exactly. About two-thirds of the precincts were covered with monitors, and so the final results from that tally are from only 60%
And so the idea is essentially to record the figures that the precincts have before they're passed up the chain, so that there can't be any fiddling with the numbers, basically, right?
Exactly.
And
to compare, right?
Right.
The final difference between the Golos numbers and the official tally was about 2%, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's within the margin of error, it seems to me. It's just that the issue was this very, very specific 50% mark,
right?
You know, if we were talking, 59.5% versus 61.5%, there wouldn't be much of a to-do about that.
Sure.
Going back to people trying to get out the vote, some of the ways that they were trying to do that would probably seem counterintuitive to a lot of people, right? Because there was a lot of sort of shaming, a lot of sort of humorous
abuse,
right?
Right.
And some of it not very humorous. Some of it seemed very genuine.
Well, it's always hard to tell. It's probably harder for me to tell than you. But if you're not a native Russian speaker, the Russian blogosphere is very. It's all built on inside jokes and sort of understood. Yeah, insults, but and most of the time they're kind of meant with a smirk. But it's difficult to know when it's sort of real kind of aggression.
Right. So with some people, at least with some people, you just know that, all right, this blogger does not have a sense of humor. So when they're saying something extremely abusive, they're probably meaning it.
Right.
And sometimes even if it is meant to be humorous, you know, it's just, it wouldn't be kosher in any other environment.
Sure.
There's definitely a lot of claims of treachery and just collaboration with
sure.
the government and all that.
Right. Well, why don't we let me move on to another question.
Sure.
This one gets outside of Moscow, which is something we should do because, I mean, Moscow was only one of like 7,000 contests throughout Russia. The question that I have is, the two most prominent, it does involve Navalny, but it gets us over to Yekaterinburg and Roizman. Now, for those who do not know, Yevgeny Roizman was the opposition candidate in Yekaterinburg, which is the fourth largest city in Moscow, and he won in Russia, right. And he won the mayor's position there. So the question is, the two most prominent Russian opposition members running for mayor's offices were Navalny and Roizman. Both these men are also very visible bloggers, and both put their social media presence to work in their campaigns. Now, what role exactly do their blogs play in their campaigns, and how fair is it to identify these candidates as bloggers? Like, what does the label capture? What does it miss? What do you think, Andre?
I think Navalny is definitely a blogger, and I think Roizman isn't. And you can almost go by how it is that they started, how it is that they became famous. Roizman did not become famous as a blogger, right? He became famous as a social activist, a person who runs an NGO, a poet even, right?
Sure.
And then a Duma deputy for several years before he was sort of kicked out.
Or right.
Forced out, I should say.
Right.
Whereas Navalny really gained prominence online through his blog and through his blogging activities, through his corruption fighting activities. Even though before that, for some time he was a relatively high up honcho in the Moscow Yabloko liberal party committee. So he was a party functionary for some time, but wasn't really prominent at that point. And then became a blogger, and over a period of about, I'd say, 4 or 5 years, right, he really achieved, what he has now, which is a steady audience of about 100,000 people, I would say. That would answer the question of how did their blogs affect their campaigns, right? Roizman's blog is mainly updates, right, of his NGO activities and maybe, in the few weeks before the election, he had more sort of lifelike posts, I would say. Would
sure.
You agree?
Yeah.
So there definitely was an attempt on his part to make his blog more of a campaigning sort of source. But I think for campaigning and for information coverage, he mainly relied Znak.ru, which is, for those of you who don't know, is a Urals-based newspaper run by Roizman's girlfriend. Oksana Panova, who has really been very good about covering the entire thing and publicizing. And in fact, some people say that she's the reason why he won, because as the polls were coming in, she publicized them and took them federal, and that made it harder for Roizman's opponents to steal the election by basically throwing in fake ballots and all that stuff, and for the falsifications.
Right.
Now, you know, and on the other hand, Navalny has always worked for his blog, and you know, did it. The real question is, did it have more of an impact during election season than it usually does? I would say probably not. I'd say probably more his actual on the ground campaign probably changed a lot more minds of people who don't regularly read him anyway, right? His regular audience would have already voted for him.
Right.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think I agree with you on all those points. I mean, one thing I think that's interesting is that Roizman, who has a reasonable audience with his blog, Navalny, who has a very big audience with his blog, they both, what's that?
Hold on a second. Do you hear the cat?
Yes.
I'm going to go let the cat out.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So, for all those still listening, what I'll say is one of the things that I think is interesting about the way that Navalny, the way that Roizman ran their campaigns is, yes, they used their blogs. Now, Roizman, what he would do, he would typically post these updates about basically how people would come to his office and ask for help, and it would be help in all kinds of different sort of walks of life. It would be sometimes someone had a dispute with their neighbor, sometimes someone needed help finding government aid for their neighbor's friend's daughter. It was a very interesting thing to read on his blog that he was bringing out in the run up to the election. As Andre pointed out, his life partner, Oksana Panova, she runs this web portal that's the sort of reinvention of another newspaper that now is very critical of Roizman, of her, Znak.com, or is it Znak.ru? Znak.com, I think.
Yeah.
But at any .com, right?
I think.
But at any rate,
yes,
that's and Navalny's campaign also, he's regularly posting sort of updates about the campaign, updates about what it is he's talking about. But on both scores, they both, I think the strength of their campaigns was that they went out to people that they, I mean, Navalny had like 4 or 5 meetings a day where his campaign would basically just set up a stage and he would talk to anywhere between like 300 and 500 people and go through the same show.
Right, local constituents in different areas of Moscow, which is really, otherwise it would be impossible to cover, there are 7 million voters, 12 million people living in Moscow.
Right.
It's a huge geographical area as well.
Well, and Roizman did roughly the same thing. There was a short kind of documentary film put out on Lianta.ru, which is another kind of news portal online website. And it was a documentary, a short film they made trailing him on the campaign trail. And his sort of meetings with the public were even more kind of grassroots, kind of underfunded activities than
right.
Navalny.
No stage.
He's
no
mics.
Yeah.
He's just yelling. He's swearing. He's staying in the mud. He's getting worked up and kind of emotional and so on. I mean, the irony here, I think, is that Roizman is far more kind of embedded in the system. He's been in the Duma. He is a member of a more. He's a member of a party that I think is kind of considered to be closer to the establishment than the party that Navalny ran in. He ran in in RPR Parnas, which is, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. And he distanced himself as much as possible from the party while he was running. Now, Roizman didn't exactly run on the ticket of "Look at me, I'm in the Civic Platform," which is the party that was founded by the billionaire Mikhail Prokhorov. But his relationship with Prokhorov is pretty tight. And so I think that it's just interesting that he ran the more kind of grassroots campaign, given that he's the one with closer ties to, in fact, his candidacy was essentially endorsed by Vyacheslav Volodin in the Kremlin, who is essentially the kind of the ideological grandmaster of the current Kremlin policy.
But then again, so was Navalny's.
Not as explicitly. Navalny's campaign. Navalny's campaign was allowed because Navalny was convicted and sentenced to 5 years in prison for embezzling about $500,000, I think. He was immediately released and allowed to run in the mayor election. So certainly there were sort of machinations that allowed that to take place, and somebody in the Kremlin signed off on it. But with Roizman, they're actually Volodin convened a kind of a group of political kind of experts about a week or two before the election, and basically said that he'd be fine with Roizman taking office. So the point that I'm trying to make is just it's curious.
I think that was Roizman was just an example. So he convened the group in order to speak about an overall sort of idea that the Kremlin's new policy is to be fine with open local elections and as little control as possible. And then he gave Roizman as an example of one person that the Kremlin would not object to being in power.
Right, but Roizman's not just a sort of a random example. Between Navalny and Roizman, maybe Gudkov in the governor's election, there weren't really any kind of prominent oppositionists running for major offices.
Sure, but Roizman was also the only one who really stood the chance of winning.
That's true, right.
So
it's strange that his campaign, despite being, it was projected to win, he has ties and he has endorsements that would suggest that it was gonna win,
right.
And yet his campaign was pretty kind of grassroots seeming, and he ran on his own reputation and he ran kind of standing in the mud, whereas Navalny, a blogger, kind of self-made man, also without the ties. I mean, he ran a kind of more traditional, at least
in
traditional,
the Western
maybe
sense,
in the West,
right.
Let's say. Yes, in the Western sense. But I mean, it was polished. It was a far more polished campaign. But neither of these guys, and I think we agree on this point, neither of them, neither Roizman nor Navalny, neither of them were able to leverage their blog or their blogs into in order to expand and capture more constituents. It required kind of going to the people and being out on the ground.
Yeah, and I think more so for Roizman. I mean, Navalny at least was able to mobilize his online supporters, right, through his blog by constantly pestering them, basically, and go out and vote. I don't think, Roizman didn't even do that, and if you think about it, his blog audience is lower than Navalny's, and a lot of it comes from Moscow, comes from cities other than Yekaterinburg. So he's really not speaking to the people who read his blog as constituents. He's speaking to them, as more like just supporters, general supporters, right?
Sure.
Whereas to speak to constituents, then he has to go out and print flyers or go out and talk to them personally, right? Or just depend on the fact that local people know who he is because they come to him, as you had once said, as if he were some sort of feudal lord.
Right.
Maybe we could talk a little bit about that because he covers that. He's covered that in his blog quite a bit.
Right.
Right.
Well, so this is an interesting point. Roizman, he does. He kind of he catalogs how people come visit him in his office, essentially asking for
his NGO office,
Right, his NGO office, right.
Yeah.
Asking for him to kind of mediate, negotiate, assist, and aid in all manner of kind of life issues. And his blog is basically, it's meant, I mean, anybody visiting it is meant to see this is a man who helps the people, but he's also kind of above the people in some way. They come to him, and he's the sort of arbiter of disputes and so on. Navalny's blog is, I mean, he does not present himself as a feudal lord or anything like that. He's not really arbitrating issues like that, but it is very centered on his personality, I think. Certainly his campaign was built around who he is, what he symbolizes, and so on. He had a political platform.
On what he's not, right?
Sure, right. He's not the Kremlin. He's not the same old thing. But right. He did stake positions. I don't think that's what interested people, and it's not what drove his blogging or his offline campaigning also either. Because he did have a political campaign that involved fielding private police on the streets of Moscow, involved cracking down on the failures to teach the Russian language to immigrants and sort of things like this, things that speak to his sort of nationalist liberal political mindset. But that wasn't what really motivated the campaign. It didn't drive it. And the same thing, I think, can be said of Roizman. And their blogging and their campaigning, it focuses a lot on kind of personality cults and kind of just a sort of generic general populism that is not based on any particular kind of political ideology.
Sure. No, there's definitely very, very little. Let me plug in here. There's very little political ideology in both of them.
I mean, right.
I'd say in Navalny, at least, there is a clear sort of streak of anti-Kremlinism or anti-Putinism, right? In fact, many people made fun of his campaign exactly for that reason, because, you know, what would he as a mayor do about corruption in the Kremlin,
right?
There isn't really anything that he could,
right?
So,
well, then that's why there's speculation about his campaign wasn't really for the mayor's office. He knew he'd lose it. He was just trying to build up a political reputation that he could take a stab at the presidency in so many years.
Six years down the road. Well, first come the parliament elections in four years.
Right. Well, once he takes control of the parliament, he'll he'll just impeach the president. So it might be sooner than 6 years. So why don't we move on to another question? Andre, I think this is one of yours. How effective was online misinformation in this political campaign, or how effective is it in any kind of modern political campaign? How effective is negative campaigning, especially in the ideologically polarized world of the Russian internet? What do you think?
Well, that's my question, so it's to you.
Oh, okay. So Runeneca, we tracked a few of the kind of headlining efforts to drum up black PR on Navalny. Probably the biggest one to come out of a blogger or anything online where it was the real estate company that it turned out Navalny had founded in Montenegro. And then his campaign compounded the kind of political damage when his campaign manager, Leonid Volkov, responded by claiming that the information that had been discovered by pro-Kremlin bloggers was actually the result of like a hack, and it wasn't really on the site. And then, of course, when the Montenegrin tax authorities released a press statement saying, actually, we weren't hacked, it's really there, the Navalny campaign kind of it made a mountain out of what was a molehill. Because it turns out that the election commission, the Moscow election commission, shortly thereafter released a statement saying, doesn't matter if Navalny has a real estate company in Montenegro, if there's no bank account or property involved, if it's just a company, then that's not illegal. He should have declared it, but the fact that he didn't isn't grounds for disqualify him. And so Volkov basically just, I think he worried many, I think that there is a kind of, there's a fear about about Navalny, about the Navalny phenomenon, it's not that he's ideologically an extremist, but that on sort of a personal level, he and his people are prone to kind of hubris, and the attacks that they make are often sort of ad hominems, or they're vicious in a way that I don't think a kind of that a lot of Russians, that they, it's not something they either respect or want or are willing to tolerate in their public officials. Now that I hear myself saying that out loud, Putin is one of the sort of best insulters of any politician around.
True.
So I mean, perhaps he's
true.
Forgiven this, but I think there's a lot of the viciousness that comes out of Navalny, and the Party of Crooks and Thieves is both kind of his claim to fame as the one of the most like popular political memes of Russian modern political history, but at the same time it's sort of become all that he's about in some ways, I suppose, and also. Just today or the other day, he posted a sort of explanation or summary of the legal complaints that he's delivered to the Moscow City Court about protesting the final tally, saying that there were these irregularities and so on and so forth. Even in that, I think he refers to either the Sobyanin campaign or maybe even the court or maybe the election commission, but they're all card sharps and they're all like crooks and stuff, I think that he's often pushed into saying something like this by what is essentially black PR. People come after him because he's someone to go after, and he often sort of fuels the fire by reacting in his kind of exciting way. I mean, in part, I think it attracts people to him because he's this sort of firebrand, but at the same time, it puts a ceiling on his potential if he keeps talking like that.
And it definitely takes away from his seriousness as a candidate, right? Because, you know, calling his opposition crooks and thieves and card sharps, you know, that doesn't change the fact that they're in political power, you know, that they are serious people, they may be corrupt, but, you know, just simply insulting them willy-nilly isn't going to change anything, right? It's a good populist tactic, but only to a certain extent. Now, I would say that a lot of his campaign was actually very negative on Navalny's part, right? And a lot of it was done through the blogs, right? Mm. They went after Sobyanin's wife. They went after both of his daughters.
Right.
The issue was they owned some property that were supposed to have been able to afford, but you know it's all very sort of hearsay based and strange, right? But you know. That to me is sort of an unattractive quality, but was it effective? Potentially, right? Sobyanin's ratings did drop. His negative did increase.
Right.
Even though people usually say that negative campaigning doesn't work, you know.
Yeah. No. It's interesting. So. It's interesting whether this is sort of the story of kind of like of netizens or actors in the blogosphere coming of age, and so Navalny will kind of grow out of it, and the more of a real politician he becomes, the less he'll sort of speak in memes, or maybe that's really at the core of him. Maybe he is such a blogger that it would be un-Navalny-like to drop that from his rhetoric and repertoire. So it'll be interesting to see.
Well, I don't know how real that is, because he didn't start really blogging until, you know, about 5 years ago, right? You know, he had a live journal maybe since 2007, 2005, something like that, right? He was really offline before that, and he was never really active in the Russian sort of online community, the Russian online tusovka, if you will, of the late 90s and early 2000s. So, you know, he in a lot of ways, is a newcomer, right, compared to some people. And so his meme usage is quite. It seems to me it's sometimes disingenuous, right? Like just like his attempts to during this campaign, his campaign bought an ad space in a popular Kontakte, which is a Russian social network group, which basically posts really, really silly pictures and really, really silly memes, and his face was just on the sort of front, the splash page of that, and like next to, you know, a cat on a toilet, basically, or you know, scandalous women.
Well, right? I think that's as good a note as any to end on. So I want to thank everybody who was able to tune in live and anybody who's watching afterwards. So remember that the final image we're leaving you with to take away about the Russian elections, the Russian regional and local elections this past Sunday, is Navalny and a cat on a toilet. all right? So thanks very much, and I hope we can do this again soon. Thanks, Andrei, for joining.
All right, thank you.
All right.